This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Amid offers to mediate the nuclear dispute with North Korea, President Bush said today that he would reconsider a plan to provide energy and food aid if North Korea scraps its nuclear weapons programs.
I view this as an opportunity to bind together nations in the neighborhood and around the world to make it clear to the North Koreans that we expect this issue to be resolved peacefully, and we expect them to disarm.
The Bush administration has clearly softened its position over the past several days, though still insisting it will not reward Pyongyang for violating its agreements nor renegotiate. The White House welcomed North Korea's indirect talks with former U.N. Ambassador Bill Richardson over the weekend and has now put oil and food back on the table. Pyongyang, however, denounced Washington's efforts as insincere, and earlier today it issued new threats to escalate the crisis if sanctions are imposed. For all of the headlines in recent weeks, most of us know very little about North Korea and its people by design. Relatively few Americans visit. Most of them are confined to the capital city, Pyongyang. We often hear of a country on the brink of starvation and economic collapse. What's it actually like in North Korea? What do people there watch and listen to? How do they get around? Do they plow behind animals or tractors? How much can visitors really see? We're going to hear from four people who spent time in North Korea, a journalist, a professor, a tourist, and an aid worker. What do you want to know about life in North Korea? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Brian McKenna, who's a documentary filmmaker who spent 8 days in North Korea this past October making a film about the Korean War. Brian McKenna joins us from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Montreal. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Thanks very much for being with us. There are not an awful lot of Westerners who visit North Korea, but what we hear is something about a country that seems to be run like a cult, everyone blindly following Kim Jong-il and to an extent his late father. Is that what you found?
It was a journey to the saddest and strangest place that I've ever been to on this earth. I've been to, you know, I've covered the tumult in Latin America during the war in El Salvador and Argentina. I did a lot of work in the old East Bloc and in the Soviet Union. And a journey to Pyongyang is like a journey to no place I've ever been before, both in terms of psychology, in terms of the way people live, in terms of, you know, presenting their international airport. Just to start, as you land in Pyongyang, this is an international airport for a city of 2 million people. There are 3 flights a week. You know, there's more flights to the northern Canadian city of Tuktoyaktuk than to Pyongyang, the capital city of North Korea. And you arrive and, you know, there's this tumult surrounding a big deal. It's one of the 3 flights that come in. Two come from Beijing and one from Shenyang in China.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the big deal. The flight arrives and we're met. We're a team of 4 people. We're met by 4 minders, 3 of whom stay with us for the entire journey. And you know, we're doing a film on the Korean War, so our minds are sort of back 50 years. You're taking in, you know, everything that's going on around you all the time. And I'm just trying to get to your question, to answer in terms of a cult, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It took us a while to figure out that we were in the middle of a cult. I mean, you know, I must say that a lot of the propaganda surrounding North Korea we dismissed as sort of, you know, the Western media deciding that they're going to demonize
stuff.
North Korea.
Right.
That's
yeah.
right. The axis of evil, et cetera, et cetera. And for a while, you just think you're in like the axis of crazy. You know, this. I mean, they tell you about Kim Jong-il's great golf game. His last game, 5 under par. I'm sorry, 5 holes in 1 and 26 under par. And this is with a straight face, and you say, oh, well, okay, and there's no smile, and okay, you're supposed to take this seriously. They're crazy, you know. But then we got into a discussion of the politics of, you know, power in that country. And I said, in a Marxist state, how do you justify transferring state power from father to son? Isn't that medieval? And our chief minder, we were in a van at that time, our chief minder turned to me and said, basically, how dare you? He said, Kim Il-jong is the leader of this country because he is a genius. He is a genius and he is the best possible person for the job. It is a coincidence that he is the son of Kim Il-sung, the great leader, that the dear leader is there because he is a genius of the revolution. And you wait for the smile and then you realize this is crazier than you could possibly believe. But then we get into a discussion of the nuclear issue. And, you know, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists say it's prudent to assume that they have two nuclear weapons.
Secretary of State Powell said the same thing, so.
That's right. So they coincide. The question is, have they been able to fit them to the intercontinental missiles that they've equipped? And we got into a discussion, you know, they said, we are a sovereign country, we have a right to nuclear weapons, without admitting they had them. Mm-hmm. They said, you know, the United States has 6,000 operational warheads, we may have some, but the question is, do we have the right? And if we're attacked, do we have the right to respond? And he said, you know, we're perfectly willing to respond. He said, if they attack us, we won't hit their bases in South Korea, we'll hit Seattle. And I thought, oh my God, and he's serious. You know, it's like Moonies with missiles now. And they have a million-man army. It's grown 200,000 since the Great Famine began. You know, more and more resources concentrated towards the military as more and more people have been starving.
Now, there's a word you use in there that's going to be very important as we continue this discussion, and that's minder. These are, what, officials from the Ministry of Information?
In this case, you organize a host organization. We say, we're coming, we're coming. We ask if we can come, and they finally, after long deliberation, say, okay. Then they say, your host will be the Democratic Lawyers Association. They're not Democratic, they're not lawyers, but they're your host. So three people whose cards say Democratic Lawyers Association, speaking perfect English, are then assigned to you and with you at all times. They sleep. One of them sleeps. They take turns sleeping, you know, in the same on the same hotel floor. Mm-hmm. They're in the vehicle with us all the time. Every time we take out the camera, it's with their permission or not with their permission. And they assiduously control or attempt to control every image that goes out into the world about North Korea.
To the extent of controlling the images you take in your Kodak?
No. Because, you know, you catch on after a while. You know, we've been around the block. You begin to understand that if you ask to stop and take a picture of the great leader and the dear leader, or the great leader alone or the dear leader alone, you know, a great big billboard or a mm-hmm. mosaic, and basically every kilometer somewhere in the country there's something like that, they'll stop instantly and take out the camera, and we set up. And they got used to us. You know, we're shooting documentaries, so we're taking some time to get some really good images. So we'd take those shots, and then we'd talk. You know, we'd distract the minders, and the cameras would wander, and we'd start to pick up people. But it's interesting. You know, you'd pick up people off in the fields. You know, with the ox cart. The tractors are. Most of the tractors don't work anymore, or they've run out of fuel. So we're back to the ox cart, or like, you know, you have a battalion of the army out there finishing off the rice harvest with the peasant population. These are incredible shots, mm-hmm. and we're able to get some of them because, you know, we let the camera wander.
I understand that you were there during an air raid drill?
Well, once the saber-rattling started in mid-October with the visit from some Kelly, and then he came out and said that they've restarted their nuclear program, and you could just feel the tension in the air as we arrived. And we were on top of one of the giant monuments. This is a city of monuments, mostly dedicated to the great leader, the dear leader, their glorious victories in the war. All alone they beat the Japanese. All alone they sort of beat the Americans. This is their sort of standard propaganda view.
Mm-hmm.
We were on top of one of these monuments, and suddenly you heard the air raid sirens go, and it looks really serious because down below you see the city begin to run, and it's a city of 2 million people. The streets emptied in 15 minutes. And we followed them down below ground, down into a subway tunnel, down an escalator, 200 meters, you know, almost 200 yards down the escalator. The actual thing is 100 meters below the earth, through, as one of our minders pointed out to us, triple blast doors capable of sustaining a nuclear attack, a direct hit on Pyongyang. And there the people gathered for the next 45 minutes or so for this air raid drill. And they have these, you never know when they're going to come, and they suddenly happen, and they're treated as if the war is on. For them, the Korean War is an unfinished war. You know, it was stopped by an armistice. As far as they're concerned, it was only stopped. As far as they're concerned, and you sort of tell from the rhetoric over especially the last few days, mm-hmm. that they consider themselves basically at war with the United States, at war with South Korea, at war with Japan.
Well, joining us now is Han S. Park, a political science professor and director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia at Athens. He helped arrange this weekend's meeting with Governor Bill Richardson and North Korean envoys. He's traveled to North Korea over 30 times, and he's with us from the studios of member station WUGA in Athens, Georgia. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
You've been listening to Brian McKenna talk about his impressions of Korea and North Korea. Can we step back for a moment and establish some facts? How many people live in North Korea, and what do we know about their quality of life?
Yeah, I'm so anxious to counter Brian McKenna's remarks. Anyway, 23 million people there. It's a fairly limited in terms of arable land. Traditionally, Korea has never had enough food produced, and so forth. And I can, you and me, go ahead. There are some points that I would.
Well, why don't you go ahead then, if you've got some.
I think, North Korea, to characterize North Korea as an outlaw, which is using blackmail to extract much needed resources, concessions from the United States and everywhere else. So that's a little too simplistic and perhaps unfair characterization. When you go to North Korea, you feel that you're in war zone. In fact, it's not only to them Korean War is unfinished. The Korea War has not been concluded, period. If you go to North Korea, you are in war zone. South Korea, DMZ, you are at combat field. And I think the war should have been concluded decades ago. I don't know why the war is lingering on. In fact, we're asking our enemies across the border that feels a serious sense of security threat and on every day. We're asking them to demilitarize, to stop making weapons. They're not going to listen. If we believe what they say, we're being utterly naive. And we have to understand that they have an intense sense of fear, and they have established a cultic society, sort of religious cult. There's no question about that. It's not really Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist state anymore. They don't need to employ coercive measures to control the people. And you use brainwash, I use political indoctrination or political socialization. The people are very, very socialized into believing that the country, the people, they are surrounded by hostile world, hostile international environment, physically as well as politically. And in fact, North Korea lost its allies, the Soviet Union's gone, Eastern European countries all disappeared, China has changed a great deal, whereas you have South Korean economy 20 times as strong as North Korea. You have 36,000 ground troops equipped with sophisticated weapons. They feel intense sense of security. I don't have to agree with them, but I can empathize, put myself in their shoes. When your security is threatened, as long as and as intensely as they have been, nothing can be managed normally. That's what we see in North Korea.
We're talking about life inside North Korea. When we come back after a short break, we'll take your calls. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. With us now are Brian McKenna and Han Park, both people who spent at least some time in North Korea. If you have questions about what life there is like, what do the people eat? Is there beer? Give us a call. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about North Korea today and what it's like to live there and visit. Our guests are Han S. Park, political science professor, director of the Center for Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia at Athens, and Brian McKenna, a Canadian documentary filmmaker who was recently in North Korea. Of course, we welcome your contributions. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Professor Park, off what you were describing a moment ago about what the Korean people believe, here's an email question from Rob Creighton in Boise, Idaho. Is there a radio-free Korea or a similar source of outside information? How widely listened to or believed is the information?
The information is extremely controlled. There is no radio readily available. If available, channels are fixed. There is no shortwave freely available in North Korea. Certainly, there's television sets available all over, but they're limited programs and so forth. They are very careful about what people get by way of airwave and so on. Mm-hmm. So there's no question about the fact that information is extremely censored and controlled.
Brian McKenna, did you spend any time watching Korean TV?
Yes, when you're sort of come back to your hotel in the evening after a long day shooting, you basically retreat to your hotel room. And essentially, there were two channels, both controlled by the North Korean government. One had sort of endless sort of grade B propaganda dramas about mostly about the Second World War and the Korean War, especially the Korean War. And what news was, you know, very carefully controlled. It felt like the old Soviet Union in its worst days. Absolute control of information. And in terms of radio, there's, I think, two radio channels that you're allowed that are, you know, you're allowed to listen to, and if you're caught trying to listen to anything else that comes across from the south, anything that might not be jammed, you're punished for a political crime, for political dissent, and there's a chance that if you build up that kind of dissent, you'll end up in a quite a desperate gulag.
Han Park, is it accurate that people have speakers in their houses that they can obviously only tune to one of these two radio stations?
Not really in their houses. Where the equipments, television, radio, are not readily available. There are various villages and communities in small rural areas, for example. You have a community collective speakers. You have loudspeakers and songs and some political announcements are constantly dispatched.
I see.
So, yes, but not in the bedroom. I visited various homes. I didn't see that.
What are people's homes there like?
You know, that's the other side of North Korea. We tend to portray North Korea based on two things, militant North Korea and starving poor North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are people just like us living there. And when children are starving, the parents are really agonizing over. And their feelings, when students come home with good grades, the entire family members are elated and celebrating. So they're real life there, and we're not seeing that. Of course, North Korea is not allowing Western journalists, and I think, Mr. McKenna, you're lucky you have been able to go into there, but it's very difficult for Western journalists to go, especially visiting regular homes and trying to get hold of their information, their grassroots level their lifestyle. It's going to be very difficult. But I can tell you that North Korea may be unconventional and so forth, but people, when children are born, they're children are children everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the same kind of family feelings and desires and so forth. And the problem is the deprivation of basic needs. Then people ask,
picking
why
up on
North
what
Korea?
The professor is saying,
sure.
There.
Right.
Go ahead, Brian.
Children are children, and children are starving right now as we speak in North Korea. The average, you know, the Great Famine, and it is a great famine, the estimate is up to 1 million people have died, is 7 years old. The average 7-year-old boy in North Korea is about 3'2" high. His counterpart in the South is about 4 feet high. The average boy in North Korea weighs about 16 kilos, about 35, 36, 37 pounds. His counterpart in the South weighs about 50 pounds. So this, the way the World Food Program people we spoke to, there's one American in the country, and he's one of the principal people with the World Food Program. He said, the terms we use are stunted and wasted from you know, the time they're in the womb all the way through. You never recover this.
That's I agree with that. That's the tragedy. Certainly you will see everywhere signs of malnutrition, schools and kindergartens and orphanages, especially orphanages, children are starving. Then the question is, we simply attribute that to the failure of the political system. There are certain elements of that, but there are certain other elements, external environments and natural disaster. But what is the bottom line here is we cannot ask and force a government with politicians. Politicians' prime objective is stay in power everywhere, including the United States. We cannot force them to risk their political life in favor of economic development, say. And I think we should be realistic in expecting from North Korean leadership.
Let's go now to James, who's on the line with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm a South Korean American, and every time my parents hear, and any friends of my parents hear these folk songs about these mountains in North Korea, I mean, it's just a very emotional topic for them, and it brings tears to everybody's eyes about this yearning for reunification. I wanted to know if there was that emotional component in the North of this great sadness regarding the other side, and whether that was as prevalent as it is in South Korea.
Well, Han Park, you might know more about that.
Yes, North Koreans, the desire for reunification on the part of North Koreans is far higher, far stronger than that in South Korea. South Korean, very developed capitalist system, individualistic and so forth. But North Korean, from birth to death, they're always taught that reunification and the lack of reunification is the root cause of all the miseries. So they're longing for desire. On the other hand, they're not, through their education, they're not envying what they see in the South. What they see in the South, they admit that economic development is fairly advanced. That's objective, and they all know that. But at the same time, spiritual, they call cultural pollution, consumerism, and all these, and as a result, the culture in South Korea is something not consistent with the sovereign state. And I think that is a very thoroughly educated, and they feel sympathy for that aspect of South Korea.
Thanks very much,
James.
I have
found an incredible amount of emotionalism, actually. You're interviewing, a young person, you know, in their early 30s, one of the soldiers commanding one of the units at the demilitarized zone. And this North Korean soldier is sort of talking about his family and what they went through. And suddenly he just starts weeping. And I turn around, and two of our minders are weeping. And the story he has told, I mean, I've heard some terrible stories that have made me weep, including some in Korea, but they're just sort of trailing this ordinary story about fighting in the mountains, and suddenly the tears are pouring down, and it's sort of tapping into an emotional well. We went to the border, and the colonel, they added a colonel as one of our minders at the DMZ, and they wouldn't let us film anything there, except until once we got to the border, then we were able to film anything we wanted for some reason, but we couldn't film along the way where the troops were taking in the harvest. And could we stop here? Could we stop here? And finally, he said, "Why don't we just start singing?" And this North Korean officer led this sing song in the van as we're going through, you know, just another part of this surreal expedition we were on.
Well, Brian McKenna, I know you have to leave us now. We appreciate you taking your time. Your film about the Korean War, when is it likely to be done?
It'll be done for this fall. War in Korea.
War in Korea.
The unfinished war.
And have you arranged a distributor in the States?
Not yet, but we're working on it.
Well, good luck. We look forward to seeing it.
Thank you very much, Neil. It's been a real pleasure.
Brian McKenna is a documentary filmmaker, and he was speaking with us from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Montreal, Canada. Email question for Professor Park from Cornelia Boylston in Boulder, Colorado. What are the schools like in North Korea? Do all the children attend school? For how many years do they attend school, and what are they taught?
Yes, in terms of a school system, they have 11-year compulsory or public mandatory school. That is, for a country such an economic problems, it's very, very strong. Not many countries do have 11. We have 12 years here. And what basically political education is the most important component. You have to be believing in what is referred to as a self-reliance doctrine. In Korean, it says juche. The juche doctrine is so important. So children will learn using various very concrete examples the virtue of that belief. And that belief basically is human determinism, and based on that, political self-determinism of any nation. In fact, what haunted North Korea was economic self-reliance. And nowadays, you have to be part of international market system, and North Korea has refused and chose not to. And that's partly responsible for the economic difficulty.
And the isolation.
And, political education is very, very strong. And also, they emphasize art education. They have a slogan, each child must learn two skills, and usually one in athletic and physical skill, and the other art skill. So their children are put to use, say, very, very busily. They get involved in all kinds of activities. In fact, they don't have any other spare time to be going out of bounds, so to speak. And they are very proud of the fact that they don't have any juvenile delinquency or drug use or anything like that. It's a very, very uniform kind of society. Everyone uses the same textbook, same material, go through same processes. So it is one for all for one kind of society.
Teenagers are, you know, you figure, you know, we were saying earlier, kids are kids everywhere. Teenagers are teenagers mm-hmm. everywhere, too. Surely there are teenage rebels in North Korea?
No, really. Everything is done collectively. After their schoolwork, say they come out of school, say 2:30 in the afternoon, most of them would go to special education places, like gyms, like art education studios and so forth, and where they have to spend a few hours. And not until dinner time will they be released. So they come home, they're deadly tired. In fact, one thing we have to pay attention to is the level of competition. We think competition is the monopoly of capitalist society. That's not so. In North Korea, very, very competitive system there. For example, school-level competition, athletic and performance arts and so forth, you have all competition throughout the country. And toward the end, the champion in every field will be awarded and recognized nationally. So you have a competitive activities there, a lot of competitive activities.
You can hear more about North Korea later on NPR's All Things Considered. Wendy Sherman, a former special advisor on North Korea to the Clinton administration, and historian Donald Oberdorfer of Johns Hopkins University will talk about the standoff between Washington and Pyongyang and answer questions posed by NPR listeners. That's later today on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is from his home in Berlin is Simon Bone. Mr. Bone traveled to North Korea as a tourist in 1998. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Sure, glad to be with you.
Why did you pick North Korea?
Well, I've traveled to a lot of places in Asia, and this one seemed to be one of the more difficult places to get to, and I had followed the story of the Kims and the convoluted history of the Korean War, and I was quite interested in seeing it from the northern side, as opposed to just the southern side.
As a tourist, were you able to move about freely and explore your surroundings?
Not really, no. There were a couple of occasions, such as the hotel we stayed at in Pyongyang was on an island. It was the Rugyong Island, and on that island there's only a soccer stadium and a hotel. And we were told we could walk around the island without cameras if we so chose. Nobody took up that offer.
Mm-hmm.
And up north in the Myohyang region, which is in the mountains, we were allowed to walk around at night, again without cameras. But there's only basically rural scenery to see. So, you know, no espionage would have been possible under these circumstances had we so chosen.
Were there souvenirs available, the normal touristy kind of things?
Normal.
I mean, my parents went to Pyongyang, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt. That sort of thing.
Oh, there are plenty of souvenirs, yes. I picked up a number of books and CDs and things along those lines. But the books, of course, were all about the Kims or about various monuments or scenic sites in North Korea. And the CDs, of course, were music, all basically dedicated to the party, the Kims, or North Korean history. And the other souvenirs were available, for example, I had purchased a small model of the Juche Tower in Pyongyang. There were plenty of opportunities to spend your money in North Korea, hard currency, of course. And the souvenirs that were available were quite expensive.
What was the food like?
Food for the tourists was excellent. I had no complaints. I was able to get vegetarian food. I was surprised, and it was done to a very high standard. But of course, at the same time, we paid rather a large amount of money to visit the country. So
I've read a bit of your journal of your visit to North Korea, and at one point you were in the hotel and were trying to order Korean beer.
That's correct. Yes, we were given a story that there was no beer available because of the shortage of food. They needed the wheat to make bread, and I and somebody else expressed our disappointment that we didn't have the chance to try North Korean beer, and all of a sudden there it was, and it appeared in front of us, and I must say it was quite good.
Good. And when you were traveling around in North Korea, how did you get places?
We traveled always with two guides in a minibus that was a Japanese import. It was a used Japanese bus. And we traveled around in a small group. We came from Beijing and were there for about 6 days. But at almost all times, we were accompanied by one and usually two of the guides. One of them basically had the speaking role and explained everything, and we assumed the other one had the listening role to make sure he didn't say anything that was not kosher.
Were the roads crowded, and what kind of vehicles were on them?
The road, for example, up north from Pyongyang was almost entirely empty. There was one place where we saw a segment had been washed away. And the road from Pyongyang down to Panmunjom was the only vehicles we saw, I think, were tourist buses. And there were only three or four of those. For example, on the same day we were there, there was a busload of, I believe, from Singapore, who were on basically the same itinerary.
And could you just talk to people? I mean, were you allowed to go up to people you met?
No. The guides were there, of course, to be helpful and translate, of course, but any interaction we might have had with normal Koreans, which, of course, did not really take place, but would have been translated for us by the guards, who were clearly high-ranking members of the party, so there would have been no spontaneous conversation there. We did coincidentally meet a couple of people as we were walking along with the guides, and the guides...
Simon, stay with us. We're going to bring you back after the break, and we'll also continue talking with Han Park. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about life inside North Korea. Our guests are Han Park. He's a political science professor at the University of Georgia in Athens. He's been to North Korea more than 30 times. And also with us is Simon Bone, a tourist who traveled around North Korea for several days in 1998. And our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Steve, who's on the line with us from Minneapolis.
Yes, thanks. I just wanted to bring in a little story I just heard the other day on Minnesota Public Radio here, actually, from an authoritative source. But Minnesota is one of the largest exporters to North Korea in the United States. And the reason why that is because we have... we're the producers of a donut machine that is very popular in North Korea, and that apparently little donuts are very popular in North Korea. And I think what I'm kind of interested in, first of all, and I have a follow-up after this, is to what extent are North Koreans, because we hear that they're so isolated, to what extent do they eat Western food? And number two, I think it's also something worth commenting on, is that a lot of the information that we get about North Korea or the way in which we're denied a lot of information about North Korea also in the United States. So that, you know, although we constantly frame North Korea as being this cult-like state in which is isolated from the rest of the world and not informed, we as American citizens are often not informed about very basic facts. Like, for instance, during the Korean conflict, we carpet-bombed their country and left almost no targets to be bombed during the war. And in terms of ideological spectrums within that country being very narrow, even like on today's program, we don't hear from a very authoritative critic of the U.S. foreign policy like Bruce Cummings. That doesn't happen on Talk of the Nation. We only hear from very mainstream official kind of safe critics, perhaps, but we never really hear from more substantive critics of.
Well, our goal on today's program was to talk about life in North Korea, not about policy, and try to stay away from the arguments and try to find out a little bit more about the people.
You have somebody on your program who is taking apart North Korea and providing us with all the myths that we hear about North Korea. And you don't have to be a supporter of Kim Il-jung. I certainly am not. But I'd like to hear from people like Bruce Cummings, who make substantive critiques of American foreign policy, so we can have a broader discussion of North Korea, not simply the same old stuff that we hear on talk radio or Fox News.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve.
Thank you.
And why don't we split his question into two parts and go either way. Han Park, to you in a minute. But first, Simon, his question about donut machines. Did you see anybody eating donuts in North Korea?
I did not, but I wouldn't be surprised that they would have imported a few of those. It's entirely possible that Kim Jong-il has a sweet tooth, or there are a few tourist sites such as the Mangyongdae Fun Fair in Pyongyang that are sometimes stops for tourists, and that's the kind of place you might see donuts being prepared. But I didn't see any.
Okay. Well, Simon, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate you taking your time. Simon Bone visited North Korea in 1998 as a tourist, and he spoke to us from his home in Berlin, Germany. On the other side of the question, Han Park, what about the information we get about North Korea?
And I think we are getting very distorted information and wrong information. I think the caller was wrong in characterizing this very show as being one-sided. I have emphasized that it is so important for us to empathize. You don't have to agree with them, but in order to work with them, we have to know where they're coming from. They have their own obsessions, their own problems and dilemmas, a lot of it imposed by outside. So we are not getting really proper and accurate information from North Korea. I have plenty to criticize the Bush administration's policy toward North Korea, but as the moderator said, this is not that forum.
Another day for that. An email question we got from John in South Orange, New Jersey. Has the spoken language in North Korea evolved in a different way from that spoken in the South? Do Northerners use different words, or do they have different accents?
No, that they have different accents, just like dialects. In the United States, and I live in the South, and first I came here, it was very hard to understand what was going on here. North Korean dialects, in North Korea alone, it has several distinct dialects, but they're all communicatable. They have, over the last half a century, they have developed some words that had not been used when the country was unified. Most of these words originated from Chinese, for example, but they are very, very limited. So there is no communication problem between South Koreans and North Koreans.
Okay, let's go now for a question to Jeff in Quincy, Illinois.
Yeah, the previous caller brought up something that's sort of interesting as to the truth, but it seems to me that we can probably get the most truth, if we could, by talking to those hundreds of North Korean refugees who have gotten out through Red China. What do they tell us, and why did they decide that the party line wasn't the truth?
Han Park?
I would submit that defectors and refugees are not the kind of source that we can get objective and truthful information, especially defectors. They have reason to defect from North Korea, and refugees too. They were intensely unhappy with North Korea, economically or otherwise. And also, in order to be accepted by China and perhaps South Korea, they have to portray their hardships and so forth. So it's not really, they're biased. Somehow you have to read between lines, and we have to make our own judgment as to truthful picture of North Korea.
Well, it just seems to me that if you can't believe the refugees and you can't believe the government, how do we know anything about them?
Yeah, that's what I said. You have to read between lines. and they tend to amplify certain aspects of their lives.
Okay.
And on the other hand, if you interview, the earlier Simon mentioned about the conversation with ordinary people, I have a command of the language, and I travel there, and I had no problem in engaging in conversation with North Korean grassroots people. They are shy. They don't volunteer information. They're timid and so on, but they seem to be very, very innocent. I don't think the conversation with North Koreans is a problem. One thing I'd like to correct is the expense in touring there. Certainly, they charge a lot more money for hotel room rates and meals and so forth than North Koreans are charged because it's a ration socialist system. And if you compare tour expense in North Korea with that in South is a lot more expensive. Japan, certainly, far more expensive. So certainly we, as tourists, we assess the different rates, but not enormously expensive.
Jeff, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We just have a couple of minutes left, Professor Park, and I did want to ask you about the outcome of the meetings that you helped arrange this past weekend between the former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, now the Governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson, and two North Korean envoys.
Yes, I think it's a little bit too much to say that I made that arrangement. I urged the ambassador Han Sung-yeol to meet a person like Bill Richardson, and there are a couple of others I recommended. I think there are two things very important that came out. One, the North Korean envoy clearly said that their nuclear program is not intended to produce nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, North Korea is willing to make an arrangement for the United States in bilateral relations to come in and verify. Now that they declared that they are getting out of the NPT, but they are willing to make a separate arrangement for the United States to go and verify the weapons program if negotiations go well. They're not going to give in just one-sidedly that way. So I think it's a good thing that President Bush opened the door for dialogue, and I think it has to be not giving in. It has to be a compromise. It has to be giving some and getting some. I think the outcome is not going to be that bad because North Korea is willing and prepared to compromise on their insistence on nuclear weapons program.
Well, thanks very much. By the way, you referred to NPT. Of course, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is what that stands for. Professor Park, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Han Park is a political science professor at the University of Georgia at Athens, and he was with us from the studios of member station WUGA. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.